my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I've met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. We are streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. If you hear me streaming right now, that means we're on air live right now. So wherever you're at in the country or the world, if you'd like to make that call, 530-337-1885. You can also contact me by emailing me at unspun, U-N-S-P-U-N, at kkrn.org. Our guest today is James Hogan. He is the president of the Vancouver PR firm Hogan & Associates and a chair of the David Suzuki Foundation Board. He is a tireless advocate for ethics and integrity in public relations. He founded the influential website DeSmog Blog in 2006 to expose misinformation campaigns that pollute public debate around the climate change and environment. DeSmog Blog was on the Times Magazine list of 25 best blogs of 2011. Their articles there and stories are routinely highlighted in the world's most popular news outlets and blogs, the New York Times, Dot Earth, Huffington Post, Daily Kos, Think Progress, and Tree Hugger, to name a few. He has advised a wide range of organizations, such as the governments of British Columbia and Ontario, the Dalai Lama Center, and the BC Law Society, and the BC Treaty Commission. Hogan has also served as a member of Shell's Global External Review Committee, and is the author of Climate Cover-Up and Do the Right Thing. His latest book is entitled I'm Right and You're an Idiot: The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. In the book, he points out, quote, that you can pollute public conversations in the same way that you can pollute the natural environment. We need to treat the public square with more respect and ensure the space and conditions for reasonable conversations and decisions about the serious problems we face are possible. We have no right to do otherwise. Propaganda has crept into the public discourse and made public reasoning less reliable. We are less interested, easier to manipulate, and far less likely to go to the bottom, to get to the bottom of important issues. End quote. Well, let's welcome James Hogan. James, welcome to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It is really good to have you. When I saw your book title, I didn't really realize who you were, and then I got more information about you, and I realized that the work that you're doing and the book that you produced are really an important work, because if we can't talk, if we can't work towards common goals or even have just a civil conversation, then we're in deep trouble. And let me read, there's a quote out from your prologue, and maybe we can start there, because your whole quest kind of started with a question by David Suzuki of the David Suzuki Foundation. And he asked you back in 2006, I believe, Why aren't people paying more attention? There's enough evidence we are destroying the planet. Why aren't people out in the streets? How do we motivate the public to demand action? And so I thought that might be a good starting place, since that puts you on your on the road to find out, sort of.
Right. Yeah, it's been quite a journey. It's almost 4 years, you know, going from the Himalayas to the House of Lords to interview a woman who's a baroness, who's a, one of the world's leading experts on public trust. I spent time at Harvard talking to Marshall Gantz and MIT talking to Peter Senge and, you know, just these brilliant people. Noam Chomsky was really generous to give me some time. And so I learned a lot. And one of the things that, you know, I kind of changed my mind about the focus of the book. Early on, I was thinking that it needed to be a book about about propaganda. And, in fact, the original working title of the book was Duped and How. And it was, you know, so I spent probably the first year studying the history of public relations and propaganda. But as I looked closer and you know, talked to the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and other people, I started to realize that one of the, maybe what you could call a threshold problem, is that you, before you can have mind-changing moral conversations and decisions, you actually need the space to have those conversations. And so we're not even at the point where we can have the conversations. And so we live in a world where people like me in the public relations business have undermined public confidence in objectivity itself. People think it's almost like we believe that everybody's in it for some reason, that you can't imagine somebody actually being saying something without having some personal reason, or there being some personal benefit, that really there's not very many people who are actually acting in the public good in an independent way. And that undermines science, it undermines arguments, it undermines objectivity itself. And so it makes public conversations extremely difficult. And so that became the focus of the book, is looking at this, the nature of this pollution in public discourse.
Yeah, I kind of envied you when I was looking through the different, you know, in the table of contents in your book, and I was looking through the table of contents and thought, man, he got to interview a lot of really smart people. And I have the kind of the same template here. The premise of this show was to put people that are smart and knowledgeable and constructive on the air and give them a voice. And you had that wonderful opportunity. One of the people I saw that you interviewed was Jonathan Haidt. He's a social psychologist, I believe. And it's funny because I had stumbled across his work after I saw him on Moyer's television show on PBS. And I had actually used, he has a whole battery of tests at, I think it's Your Morality or YourMorals.com. I think that's the email address. I'll look that up for people later. But you interviewed him, and I don't know whether it was tribalism. I was trying to remember exactly, but he was talking about how our morality sort of limits us. And I thought maybe you could go into that, because I really appreciated what the message was there and how important that was to what you're talking about. How do we open up a dialogue if I'm right and you're an idiot, right? So
right.
Where's the room in there for any kind of dialogue?
Right. And yes, and so he is one of the sort of key figures in the book when I'm sort of looking at the nature of the pollution in public discourse. And he talks about something he calls groupish righteousness. And he says that we're designed by evolution to divide into teams, to line ourselves up against other teams, and that process, which can be good, I mean, you know, the fact that we develop communities is an incredible thing. In fact, we need more of that. But there's something when you divide up into teams that happens that's also bad, and he says it's that we become blinded to the truth. So what happens is it's also called cultural cognition. There's work being done out of Yale by Dan Kahan on this. It's this phenomenon that where people become kind of impervious to evidence that contradicts their beliefs or the beliefs of their group. So if I feel very strongly connected to a certain group, there are all sorts of economic and social forces, deeply held values that prevent me from believing things that undermine the integrity of my group membership and of my group. And so there's a good thing to that. We do need to group together. The world is not a safe place these days. And community is a way, a community is actually a way of making the world a better place, obviously. And Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about the power of community. And so it's both a good and a bad thing, this tendency we have to group together.
And I work within certain groups, and I have for got about 15 years now as a board of directors and those different types of groups that you join when you think you have a righteous cause or when you're outraged over what some people are doing. And it can be it can be empowering, and it can also be debilitating in the sense that the more we put up walls and then they put up a wall and their wall's higher than yours, so you put up a new wall higher, and it becomes such a contentious thing. And what I found, I have a very intelligent friend, so when I went to Jonathan Haidt's website there and we took a battery of tests, and your morality, you can both be extremely moral individuals and be at odds, because morality is not this little thin slice of something that you believe is moral. There's like several bases, and I don't remember what they are. Maybe you could enlarge on that. But I found like the difference between my friend and myself was he had a very strong tendency to be loyal. And supportive and loyal, and my focus was more on being fair and just, and so we weren't able to connect. But maybe you could enlarge on that. I know you probably have a better grasp of it than I do.
Yeah, he has I think there are six sort of fundamental. They're sort of the foundations of the our kind of what he calls our moral matrix, but one of the clearest distinctions between conservatives and liberals is that liberals like change, and they're open to sort of adventure and change and new things and so on, much more than conservatives are, it's black and white. I mean, we all have a bit of each of these things in us. But conservatives tend to want stability and order, and so when things get shaken up, liberals like it, and conservatives get nervous. And both of those things are good. I mean, we don't want everything shaken up all the time, right? I mean, there are times when it needs to be shaken up, but there are times when it needs to be stable. So you kind of want a balance of them, which is one of the reasons why, when we polarize tribally, it's not necessarily in the first steps of that, or in the kind of normal way of that, that I see it as problematic. It's when it becomes almost institutionalized, and so you become purely polarized, so that Republicans and Democrats just never agree. So the days where they did agree a lot, or in Canada it's Liberals and Conservatives, when you become so that your group becomes so pure and so kind of, it's kind of like an unyielding one-sidedness that creeps in to the polarization. Things become paralyzed. And people in my industry who, people, public relations and the propaganda, they're spin, you know, as in the world, think of spin, or, you know, exaggerating certain things, or that is the least of the problems with the type of things that people in my industry do. There's more and more this tendency to polarize, so that the business of public relations becomes the redefining of, say, in the case of climate change, it was a very good example, actually taking science and defining it culturally. So it's no longer a conversation about evidence. It's actually a conversation about what team you belong to. And so you see that with evidence around gun control, immunization, climate change. They become highly partisan. And they're actually nudged into that by public relations people. So what ends up happening is that the public square becomes so polluted that you can't even see the people on the other side. And we've become very, very good at polarization and really bad at finding common ground. We can't even see the other people's point of view. So, like a friend of mine used an analogy of a football field. So you have the people who are engaged, say 20% on one side of an issue or 25% and 20 or 25% on the other side. The people who are in the stands watching the engaged people see 20 or 25% of people on the left in that end zone. And then 25% in the other end zone, nobody's in the middle actually playing the game, and all of the audience just disengages. So we live in a world where we are highly polarized. There's a lot of really interesting work done by Pew on this. Highly polarized. High levels of mistrust. High levels of fear. And then people who are very professional at propaganda and at polarizing things further mix with this, and that's the. And then I think there's also, on the part of scientists and advocates, narrative failure. And so you take all of those together, and you end up with this kind of toxic stew in the public square.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today is James Hogan, noted author, chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, and public relations professional. His latest book is I'm Right and You're an Idiot. It speaks to the toxic state of public discourse today. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and comments. Don't hesitate to call in. I'm going to have to take you straight on the air, though, if you do call in, because our call screener got sick today and couldn't come in. So when you call in, be ready to make your case or ask your question. Should I call you Jim or James?
Jim. Jim is good. Thank you.
Jim. Okay. Thank you, Jim. There's partisanship and polarity. Well, you see it at every level. I mean, every marriage could be a little microcosm of what we're talking about. Certainly, any group behavior becomes kind of that way. Once you're polarized, then you're just talking to the choir. And so, what is the best way as an individual or a person that's in a group to kind of break through these gridlock, roadblocked discussions that many times just aren't happening at all? Like you say, we're at both ends of the football field and nobody's playing in the middle to get advance something one way or the other.
Yeah, so that's the second half of my book kind of looks at that, and it's, you know, there's a lot of answers to that question, but just in general, there was a very interesting moment in the book where David Suzuki and I got a chance to spend an afternoon with the Zen Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. He was in Vancouver out at University of British Columbia. And so we sat down with him and we had tea, and then we basically had a dialogue with him about environment, environmental issues. And he was talking about the need to, he was saying, you need we need less telling people that they're destroying the planet because they already know that, and more dealing with the despair that people feel. So he's saying, and you need to bring meditation into the work of protecting the environment. So he was talking about the inner ecology, and I thought, now you're not saying that we shouldn't be activists, are you? And so I asked him that. I said, you know, listen, I heard from one of your monks that one of your monasteries in Vietnam put the pictures of policemen who are harassing the nuns and monks in the monastery up on your website to shame them because of their harassment. Now, that's activism. So you're not saying we shouldn't be activists, are you? So he has this way. I don't know if you've ever seen him or...
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, well, he has this... I was sitting like maybe a foot and a half away from him. It was an amazing experience. I've been a fan my entire life, but I'd never met him. But he looked at me, and it felt like he was kind of like peering into my soul. I mean, it's really kind of uncomfortable to have somebody be that aware of you. Like, almost like they know more about you than you do. And he looked at me with this kind of incredible silence, and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, whoa, you know, that is such a powerful way to put so many of the things that I'd been learning. And so I started thinking about that, and I realized as I was walking off the stage that we were on a stage and it was being filmed, and my wife was in this small group of people who'd been listening, and she said, so you heard what he said, right? And I thought, yeah, I kind of heard what he said, but I was still kind of stunned by it. But as the days went on afterwards, I realized that I'd been given a Zen koan by, like, probably the greatest living Zen master, or one of them, and I thought... what does that mean? You know, and so I've been thinking about it ever since. And one of the things that I think it means is, you know, he said clearly, speak the truth. So he's not saying, you know, just get along with people, you know, or sort of, you know, get along and go along with whatever's happening. He's saying that speak up, but it should be the truth. So you should know clearly what it is you're saying. And because of what complicates that as a mission, if you're trying to speak the truth, is just exactly what you were saying before, is when you start to look at people's values, the truth becomes different for the different person, the different values. So the glasses of loyalty are different than the glasses of another kind of, you know, a moral principle that, I don't know, that maybe is looking at equality. And they're not always, it's not always black and white. It's not always right and wrong. And so the truth of things is not always really something that scientists can find and then we can all agree on. It just doesn't work that way. And so part of the process of trying to get to the truth of a conversation with someone is being able to kind of stand in their shoes. And I also interviewed a woman named Karen Armstrong who wrote a book. She wrote a book called The History of God. In 2008, she won the TED Prize, and they gave her $200,000, I think. And with that, they give you the money apparently to, you know, do something to make the world a better place. She decided to get together religious leaders from around the world and write a charter for compassion. So she wrote a small book that was an agreement among these religious leaders. And one of the things they all agreed on was that all of the major religions, and even the major philosophical leaders throughout history, from, you know, Confucius to Buddha to Jesus to Muhammad to Moses, that they all agreed in some form or another on the golden rule that you shouldn't be treating other people the way you don't want to be treated. And as she stated it in the negative, I don't know why, but that... So the idea is that you don't treat people the way that you don't want to be treated. And so that, so I talked to her about that, and I talked to other people who are sort of talking about it in a little bit different way. And so what ends up happening, I think, is that speaking the truth ends up being an exercise in being able to listen. And so sitting down with someone and saying, with the intention of keeping your own mouth shut, saying, I understand, you know, I have come to understand that I haven't been listening to you or giving you a chance to tell me what it is that concerns you about this climate change or whatever it is. And really listening and not doing that thing we do where we'll listen for a bit and then jump in and correct somebody's faulty thinking. But we just listen and we leave that correcting for later. And we listen deeply so that we, and hopefully that person actually starts to see that our intentions are to actually listen and to try to come to some kind of a understanding of what it is that they're concerned about. And so rather than being critical or arguing or giving them the other side or correcting them, that we leave that till later and we just listen. And we do that so little, I think, especially when it comes, we probably do it a lot in our own families if we have successful families, but we don't do it that much in the public square. And I think, I know that activists, you know, if there's an activist listening to us right now, this can really tick them off. And I'm more of an activist than most people, I have to tell you. All you have to do is go to DSmogBlog and you'll see it. But I think that there's real value in this because you can't just be a one-trick pony. You need to be able to polarize and then depolarize. You need to be as good a listener as you are a speaker. And I think the beginning of real communications is deeply rooted in listening, deep listening. Compassionate listening, empathetic listening. And so I think in a way that's what speak the truth means, and speak the truth but not to punish, is a broader sort of understanding of that same thing, that basically we need to figure out ways to come together and to respect and assume, starting from all of this, I think the starting point in all of this is assuming that people's intentions are good.
That's a tough one for me there, assuming when you know,
well,
you
that's
make...
Not, yeah. That's not always true, but I think it's mostly true. I think if we think that we're surrounded by evil people, that we probably need to get our psyche checked. When we get ourselves into that kind of state, I think we live in a world of differences. We live in democracies. Democracies are messy. People have different ideas. Now, it is true that there are some mischief makers, but I study them. I wrote a book, Climate Cover Up, on mischief makers around climate change. And most people who deny climate change are not mischief makers. They're just people who misunderstand. They're not mischief makers. And they may misunderstand in quite a vocal way for a whole bunch of reasons that don't really have anything to do with, you know, the fact they're being paid by
Jim. Jim, I've got a caller, so I want to take this before I lose them. I don't have my. Let's see, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks a lot for this great conversation, and thank you for all your work in this crucial area of communicating with each other. You know, my question is this: you know, in a situation, I mean, what you just laid out there. I speak the truth, but not to punish. That was powerful, and I need. I'd like to tattoo that on my hand,
it on your fist.
But how far to take that? Like being in the challenge for me is being in conversations where I'm totally convinced that the person or the that I'm dealing with is being not being genuine, is being maybe evasive or being. You know, in some other way, not being genuine and out front with what we're really, really talking about. And so do you think that part of my truth could be, I feel like you're just not being genuine in our communications to push that issue? What do we do in situations like that? That's my question.
And let me just point out, this is Randy, right?
Yes, Randy.
Yeah, Randy has been one of the people on a local climate change blog that has come to the defense of the blogger because he's constantly attacked by climate deniers. It's a pretty sad thing. So what's your response there?
Because I'm going to get off the phone.
Okay, thank you, Randy, for calling.
Yeah, I think that's probably that. Right, that's right at the nut of the problem. That question from Randy, and I don't. My intention behind this book was as a student. You know, my journey was as a student. Even though I'm an older guy and been in the communications business 25 years, I think this whole area is very challenging, and I still feel that after talking to all these wise people that I spoke to. They all find it challenging, even though a lot of them have a lot to offer. But one of the things that I think it's, one of the things I like to tell my clients is that never get in a pig fight in public because the pig likes it. You both get dirty, and after a while, people can't tell the difference. And so I think that there is, it's almost like, you have to ask yourself the question of whether the conversation is going in the direction of eventual resolution. Is there a benefit to it? And if not, step away from it because you don't want to kind of allow yourself to get caught in an advocacy trap where you become just so angry that you're not of much use to yourself or anybody else. And I've been there. That's the reason why I can describe it with such familiarity. but it is, I think sometimes you just have to walk away. That doesn't mean give up, but I think that the question becomes, is this, you know, I think debating with climate change denial is really, that the debate about whether or not climate change is happening should be happening in scientific journals.
And I believe some people have gone there. There's certain scientists, you probably know them, Michael Mann, I've had him on the show, several others, the guy that has the Wonderground Weather blog, he's very good at that, communicating important information. But Randy makes a great point because we know that, I suspect, companies like Monsanto and Dow and, well, I don't know, they might be combined at this point. But certain companies are out there putting out disinformation, propaganda, as you know, and their intentions are not good. Their intentions is protect the bottom line and extend their power and profit. And so, you know, dealing with those people on that level is very hard. And so, you know, once again, back to Randy's question, and I think you kind of answered it because even the story about Thich Nhat Hanh is you don't stop protesting, but you have to be ready to, you know, listen and ready to do something, even if it's not the goal you want. Maybe it's a compromise, but maybe let's just assume that we have somebody's done something bad, and it falls, you know, partially into your responsibility because you see it, that you feel you have to take action. In fact, I even think that was a question that came up in your book is what drives good people to do bad things? And then how, if they're having a hard time recognizing it, how do you overcome? That's a tough situation. And even if we apply it to ourselves, it's still a tough situation, being able to let go of the justification, rationalization, everything that you build up. How do we get past that? I know you talked to this in the book, but maybe you can explain, you know, on a personal level, how we get past that.
Yeah, I think that there's a, the first part of the answer to that question is that there's a woman in one of the chapters of the first chapters of the book. Her name is Carol Tavris. She wrote a book on cognitive dissonance, her book is titled "Mistakes Were Made, But Not by Me." And And so she, cognitive dissonance is where self-justification comes from. So cognitive dissonance is this uncomfortable feeling that we get when we're getting pretty close to having to admit we're wrong. And we really don't like that, particularly if we've taken a position in public. So one of the reasons why continuing to fight with certain people who are like dead wrong about something, one of the reasons not to bother doing that, even though they're wrong, and even though you're right, even though you have like 97% of scientists in the world, atmospheric scientists in the world agreeing with you. So it's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's that when you, when these mechanisms of self-justification and cognitive dissonance start to kick in, people react, and it the research shows that it doesn't matter how much evidence you have. It doesn't matter that you're totally dead right, that self-justification is powerful. And Carol Tavares said it's as powerful a force as thirst and hunger. And the more you push people, particularly in public, and when they've actually, you know, taken a position that's incorrect, and the more you push them, the worse they'll get. So it ends up that you end up just in this kind of Alice in Wonderland conversation. And so that's what I mean by the pig fight. So I think trying to recognize when that happens and being able to kind of dial back from it and realize that it is a kind of a, there's a pathology at work in this. There's a social pathology in climate denial. There's a lot of fear in people. And there are powerful emotions at work here. And it's not about who's right and who's wrong. So let me just sort of shift a bit to this conversation I had with, I was listening to, or I was near the end of my book, and one of the key figures in my book, who I really strongly recommend people study everything this guy does, his name is Marshall Gantz, and he was one of the lead guys for Chavez for 25 years, a union organizing in the farming world in California, and he now is teaching organizing and public narrative at Kennedy School at Harvard. And so I took a course from him, and I'm a big student, and I teach people his method of public narrative and organizing in Canada. Anyway, so he was a big chapter in my book, and I'm listening to Bill Moyers, and on comes Marshall Gantz. And one of the things he says is, I have no time for people who say that polarization is a bad thing. Anybody who tells you that polarization is bad, it doesn't know what they're talking about. He doesn't quite say it that way, but it's essentially what he's saying. He says, polarization is what you get in democracy. Everybody getting along and no polarization is what you get in a dictatorship. We should embrace polarization. We need more polarization. And I thought, whoa. But what that conversation, so I phoned him and I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. And so he said, you need to read Rabbi Hillel. And so I said, well, who's Rabbi Hillel? And he said, Rabbi Hillel was around the time of Jesus, but he didn't have as good a marketing machine, so people don't know about him. And he said, you need to read him. So he sent me this stuff, and he said, Hillel basically says this, that there's two types of argument. There's argument for the sake of heaven, and then there's an argument that's aimed at destroying your opponent and beating your opponent. Argument for the sake of heaven is an argument that's designed to get to the truth. Argument for the sake of heaven is the type of thing that Marshall Gantz is talking about. Argument that's aimed at destroying and annihilating somebody who disagrees with you, that's not as beneficial. That's not what we strive for. That's what we try to avoid. So, I mean, sometimes it creeps in, but that shouldn't be our main purpose, was the narrative. So there is polarization that is good, and there's polarization that is bad. And so somebody who's polarizing, which is what activists do, needs to be almost kind of schizophrenic, because you need to be able to polarize to get to the truth. And sometimes that means, you know, it gets rough. But you have to be very careful. You need to be able to not just turn the volume up, you need to be able to turn the volume down. And so you know, ultimately, I think, you know, I take that and I thought, okay, well, that's really important because we need to, it's really, polarization is really important. We, the type of thing that I'm talking about with propaganda and this groupish righteousness and the role of fear and anger in the public square, this is not saying that we should tone down the argument. What I'm saying is that we're actually impeding the argument. These things, when you are involved in ad hominem attacks on people, that is not an argument. Name-calling is not an argument. Demonizing somebody who disagrees with you is not an argument. So that is what we need, is we need more passionate debate, and these things get in the way of that. And sometimes we do it. It's not just the other guy that makes mistakes, right? And so this was all really hard for me to sort of admit, because righteousness is like, self-righteousness is like a drug. You know, I'm David, you're Goliath. Don't you tell me I'm Goliath. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And great points. Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspunning Experiment of Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today is James Hogan, noted author and chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, public relations consultant, professional. His latest book is I'm Right and You're an Idiot. It speaks to the toxic state of public discourse today. You can call in if you have a question for our guest, 337-1885, area code 530-337-1885. We want you to call in, so don't hesitate. If you have something in your mind and been triggered by this conversation, call in. You'll add to the conversation, and that will benefit everybody. Also, I want the community to know KKRN has a community calendar, and if you contact Shane at KKRN.org, that's Shane at KKRN.org, he will get your event up on the community calendar, and I'll go out over the air, and then the people will know what's going on in the community. So don't hesitate. Use this as a resource. That's why we're here in the community, is to serve the community. So you can call or write an email to Shane at KKRN.org. Well, coming back to this discussion, I do believe, I don't see myself as ever being able to sit down across from George Bush. I was a big peace advocate from day one, the invasion of Iraq, and even before, but I cannot see myself ever sitting down with George Bush in a meaningful conversation and going forward from there. By the way, I have another caller, so before I lose them, we'll take that and we'll come back to what I was saying, but I don't want to lose this caller, so I'll bring him on the air. Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
This is Doug's friend he was talking about earlier.
We won't name him. He'll be anonymous.
I'll be anonymous. Okay. Say, this is a very, very, very interesting show. I basically resonate very much with it. One spin, I hate to use the word spin, but one thing I've observed in people, especially groups of people, I used to have to chair a lot of technical meetings and program meetings, and you have a lot of different opinions. And one of the things that, a little model, I'm kind of an engineer at heart, but one of the models that I kind of evolved in my mind is ego survival. And what I've noticed by people, they get to the point where their belief system, or what they believe, pretty much defines their ego. And therefore, there's anything that attacks that position is an attack on their ego, and it becomes survival. It's not a matter of the beliefs, but actually life and death. So they go into a survival mode, a territorial mode. It's the very basic, you know, animal instinct. And once it latches to that point where people are trying to survive, the fight or flight kind of thing, you're doomed, because nothing you say is going to change because a person's in this defensive survival mode. What I found, and it's in myself too, I find myself doing the same thing. And the only way I can latch out of it is to transcend it. And that gets back to the heaven thing, where you have to transcend these ego boundaries and belief bubbles. And the only way you can transcend them is to go to a higher level, a higher place that's non-dual. And then you can kind of look at these things in perspective. But most of what we see in the rhetoric between left and right and the Republican and all that is survival, territorial positions. And that's why the discourse is so violent. You see it in the Trump rallies. People are attacking each other because they're in a survival mode. This is fight or flight.
Did you have any specific question for
No, no, that was just an observation. Just an observation in a different perspective of what I've been hearing here on the show today. It's very good.
Okay. Would you like to stay on while he responds to that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, so that is very much the kind of theme that I heard in a little bit different, put a little bit differently. In fact, each of these people I talked to had a different way of saying something very similar to that. And Jonathan Haidt talks, it's interesting because in my book, Climate Cover-Up, people would ask me afterwards where the climate denial comes from, and I would just say money. And, you know, I look back on it now, and I think that was like a really superficial answer. And one of the reasons I think that is because of what I learned from Jonathan Haidt, which is he says, in fact, I think he wrote something, and the headline was, "Forget the money, follow the sacredness." And if you are starting to touch in a debate with someone, something that someone holds sacred, you know, like their ego, or the fact that they've... another way of putting it with Carol Tavris put it is, I think she calls it the pyramid of decision. And she says, okay, imagine a pyramid and there are two friends at the top of the pyramid and they make a decision. Say the decision is one of them decides they're going to cheat on an exam at university and the other one decides not to. That as after they make that decision, they will start to justify that decision. They will look for things to justify the decision, even on a small thing. And even if the decision was not that, like it may have been the decision to like walk across the street or something and something happens, but it doesn't have to be a decision that comes from a lot of thought and commitment and stuff. It can just be, you know, almost incidental. But the process is that as soon as you make the decision, you start to look for justification. And one of the things that makes you look for more justification and drives you further down this pyramid is if somebody starts criticizing you for the decision you've made. So as you go down, you become more and more committed to justifying that decision and the decisions that you made to justify it, right? So it becomes like a snowball. But you're sliding down this pyramid, and so is the other guy sliding down the pyramid until you get to the bottom of the pyramid, and you are further apart than you ever have been. And the original decision may not have been a seriously thought-out decision, but you were totally committed to this process of self-justification. So that's another way of looking at it. So when we argue with people, this idea that by fighting it out, and being, you know, presenting the evidence and so on. I mean, yes, sometimes that works, but often it doesn't because of these other mechanisms. And these other mechanisms are people who are, you know, in the midst of self-justification. They're not stupid. There's all sorts of research that shows, like, really smart people are unreasonable too. Really smart people are wrong just as often as really stupid people are, or maybe close. I mean, on a bunch of science things that I've seen over the years. So it's not how smart you are, not how well-educated you are. These are human traits. And so somebody who cares about something, whether it's on the job or, you know, climate change or social justice issues or whatever, just needs to be aware of this because you can inadvertently be triggering these reactions just because you're not very skilled at human relations.
Oh, just a point of correction here. While you were talking, I looked up in your chapter there with Carol Tavris, and it's pyramid of choice was the term she used.
Pyramid of choice, okay.
Yeah, and I think that's true. My anonymous friend and I, we've known each other since college, but we've gone, different directions. So we're somewhere down that. And we're thankfully willing to struggle enough, to climb back up those sides and realize that some of these are life choices, as you suggest. So we're able to maintain our friendship, and because of that, because we're rational enough beings that we're willing to question or see it from a different angle. So we've been able to fight up that the sides of that pyramid to realize that maybe those were choices, life choices that we made 30 years ago, so it's an interesting phenomenon.
It's more like 50 years.
Well, that would imply we're pretty old.
half a century.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much exactly what I was trying to say, is that this mode, when you get into this survival mode, it's pretty. And what I found in most cases where you have a lot of differing viewpoints, and these are smart people like you're saying, these are PhDs in science and very educated, and they all disagree. And what I found, at least in that space, is that the solution is usually a combination of everybody's ideas.
Right.
And that no one was really wrong, but no one was really right. And that, as a group, they stumbled and fumbled and found the right solution, kind of like making sausage. It was really a mess, but we got sausage at the end, and it worked.
To me, that is central. That's my concern, is because, another version of, or another iteration of what Rabbi Hillel was saying, if you fall into this argument for the sake of defeating, then you don't get to the argument for the sake of heaven anymore, right? You sort of move off in this other direction. And it seems to me that the solutions are somewhere on common ground. So there needs to be, it's not like we shouldn't be arguing vigorously, but you also need to, this other part of it, where you eventually try to, you need some mechanism to get to common ground.
Yeah. And Dennis, I'm going to hang up on you in case somebody else is trying to get on. We only have about five more minutes, but thanks for calling in.
All right, great show. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, we have, we have 5 minutes, a little under 5 minutes. And I know that, of course, your book is something that people can go to, and maybe some final thoughts and maybe a couple of links, websites, where to get your book, just good advice in general for people to get along with each other and move forward.
Yeah, I think near the end of the book, I try to focus on a number of people like Marshall Gantz and Peter Senge and the Dalai Lama, people who said things that I felt kind of tied together what the alternative is. And I think one of the parts of the pollution in public discourse is what I call narrative failure. And in the case of climate scientists, or any environmental scientist or conservation thought leader, there's this tendency to kind of believe too much in Descartes and to naively believe that facts change minds. And they don't. And they never really have. And that's not totally true. I mean, do facts do change minds if minds are open. But in the world of to and fro in the public square, facts are not enough. That we need to be better at storytelling and at narrative. And we need to be able to, I think, is a really good example. A lot of my work has been climate change, but I think of climate change as a metaphor for all of these disagreements, these big crazy disagreements that we're having. But if you look at the Pope's encyclical, I think it's a very good example of a moral narrative where you basically are talking about something in a multidimensional way that's not just the facts. It's also the hope. It's also the moral responsibilities. It's the conversation about who we are and who we should be. It's a conversation about the way the world should be as opposed to the way it is. And it's done in a way that what one of the people I interviewed, Dan Kahan, calls, what was the phrase that he used that just totally slipped my mind? It's kind of a... my mind just went blank. But what it mean? What the phrase? I can't remember. But what he meant was sort of a partisan friendly narrative. So a narrative that basically is open to. So say if you're a conservative, that your narrative leaves room for a liberal, or vice versa, right? So that you can tell stories that are inclusive of groups who disagree with you, rather than telling stories that make people who disagree with you the sort of the dragon in the story, or the sort of the evil person in the story. So it's like it's narratives where we're kind of all in this together, as opposed to it's us versus them. And so this us versus them thing is something we need to figure out a way to communicate our way out of through understanding, through empathy, through listening, and through the way we tell stories.
Yeah, I think we've alluded to Dennis alluded to it, a transcendental frame of mind, Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, that's basically what he does, is meditates even while he's walking. And there's a good Rumi poem that I have used to pretty good effect in the past in the public square. It goes like this: out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. When the soul lies down, When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too big to speak of. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. And I think that kind of encapsulates it. But to get you in that right frame of mind, if you find yourself where you're an adversarial position, and you get into that mode where you think you're actually fighting. So, well, that's our musical cue. So I want to thank you very much, James Hogan, for being on Unspun, an experiment in truth telling with us today.
Thank you.
Truly a pleasure. We could have talked 2 hours, and people are trying to call, and I want to say I'm sorry to them. I just simply couldn't put you up on the air because we didn't have that much time left on the show, but thanks for calling in. I will be putting links to your website and to your book, and I intend to read the rest of it. I have made it all the way through, but I found it very valuable. So thank you very much again for what you do and what you're doing in the world. It's really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have to say goodbye now, so I'll say goodbye.
Bye.
And maybe I'll get to talk with you again. You've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. Our guest today has been James Hogan, chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, public relations professional, and author of the recently published I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up, a truly valuable book. I highly recommend it. I'll put links to his articles, books, and blog, along with the archives of this show at kkrn.org/shows/unspun. For those of you that missed any portion of this show, it will be rebroadcast Wednesday at 4 p.m. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking to Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. One of his most recent articles is entitled A Russian Warning. So tune in next Saturday, 9 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Thanks for listening. Next up, Tom Hartman on KKRN. Stay tuned.